Call to order the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Public Safety. Colleagues, today is February 11th, 2015. We're convened for the purposes of continuing the public hearing on House Bill 5032, the budget bill of the Oregon Military Department. Linda, would you like to tee it up for us?
I would mention that we are starting on page 22 of the agency's display. The agent's thank you presentation on OLIS, and that we expect that the agency will finish the overview today. We will start tomorrow with the governor's budget and public, and then we'll have public testimony.
All right. Welcome back.
All right, thank you, Co-Chair Shields, Co-Chair Williams, and members of the committee. I'm Dave Secchi. I'm the Deputy Director for the Oregon Military Department. Recently, I got assigned that position on 1 January. Prior to that, I was the Director for the Office of Emergency Management. I don't know if you're keeping track of how many pictures and videos I have from this point forward, but it's clearly less than what the Adjutant General had yesterday. And so this is the meat of some of the bone that and the skeletal system and the mission and purpose of the National Guard and what General Hokanson was describing yesterday. And so I'd like to jump to the first slide. Actually, hold on a second. With me also is
Chair Shields, Chair Williams, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sean McCormick. I'm the policy advisor for the Oregon Military Department. Thank you.
So we have some backup help here this morning to answer your questions. So the next slide, please. Basically, I have seven program areas within the Oregon Military Department: administration, emergency management, community support, and I'll go into detail on each and every one of those. First, on the administration program. Administration program is composed of the command group. It has the financial administration, state personnel, reintegration, emergency financial assistance, education, training, and public affairs. This administration program is basically funded from a combination of federal programs, and it's also from charges from central HR and payroll and accounting support. Slide. Within the operations program, almost all these National Guard programs are funded with federal and state dollars. The majority of them, actually, after the first two, are almost exclusively federal. The first two will go into some detail on it. So first and foremost is the operations and maintenance checkmark, the very first one. This program basically operates and maintains all the facilities for the Oregon Army National Guard, and this is the Army side of this. And I'll be brief in Army Air consistently throughout this process to avoid the confusion in the future. We have basically 3.3 million square feet in the Army installation program. And so I believe that puts us somewhere in the standpoint of footprint, third across state agencies, I believe, corrections and the university system, and then we have the military department. So we have a broad range of different actions and processes. We're going to be talking education. We're going to talk the goals and missions, war fight, state support, as well as installation support, et cetera. So there's the military department is kind of all across the board in terms of the varied actions and programs that we have in this agency. But to accomplish the readiness support for our soldiers, to house those units, to ensure that they have a place to place their equipment to fall in on and to be able to deploy to a training site, we have 36 armories, as the Adjutant General mentioned yesterday. You recall that map. Four training sites, a logistics depot at Camp Withicum, and then two Army aviation support facilities. And then we have an equipment site at Camp Riley, and then we have the Regional Training Institute, the RTI, and we'll go into some detail on that. There's a project discussion that we need to have on that one out at Monmouth on Western Oregon State Campus. And then, of course, we have seven maintenance shops and the Youth Challenge site in Bend. The operations maintenance program operates basically under a cooperative agreement. So we have these agreements with the National Guard Bureau and the state of Oregon in order to ensure that money passes through correctly and is used for the proper purposes. And so you'll hear this reference of cooperative agreements consistently throughout when we're dealing with the National Guard Bureau type money or federal money. Slide. Or never mind. Construction branch basically manages, supports construction of our facilities. We have basically three broad areas in which we're constructing. And we'll talk this in terms of we have really small construction, small remodels, re-roof type actions. The medium type approach is we have a program called Army Sustainment Life.
SRM, Sustainment Readiness.
No, ASLIP.
ASLIP. Armory Service Life Extension Program.
Armory Service Life Extension Program, which basically is taking these armories from their 1950s version, my father's and grandfather's armories, to a more modern version. And it's a much bigger remodel. And then, of course, the construction branch also manages the new construction within the military department.
Colonel Stuckey, could I ask you a quick question? When it comes to purchasing and construction, do you go with GSA regulations, or is it DAS regulations that oversee the purchasing in the military department?
Good question, Co-Chair Shields. Shift.
Smart man.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Roy Swofford, the Director of Installations. So the purchasing contracting process that we follow are state laws. It's state purchasing contracting processes.
Okay, thank you.
It's interesting how they're using mostly federal money.
So our attempt today is to get as many of your questions answered today, but we certainly can do that tomorrow. And so we have this drill set up on this seat, hot seat right here. So thank you, Roy. So moving on, counter drug program, third bullet down on the left. We have basically a small S&S and utility costs in there. This counter drug program basically supports the law enforcement agencies across this. It's 100% federal. We have 9 federal employees. These are mostly analyst type people. They fall in on the 14 of the 21 different community-based organizations that help support and come up with policy and actions to fight the drugs. We also have LAVs. We have a light armored vehicle support for those that remember, or you may have seen the LAVs go down the highways, an old Marine Corps vehicle. And so from the standpoint of the counter drug, they will help with law enforcement, both on drug raids, but most of the actions they do is in support of those law enforcement agencies and the analyst component of this. Next bullet, the environmental program, 11 state employees basically managing the state property and what we do on the environmental footprint, training sites, armories, new construction, et cetera, a hazardous material, that type of thing, 100% federally funded. Camp Rylea Dining and Billeting, very small. We have Camp Rylea on the coast between Astoria and Seaside. It's a fairly extensive training post for us, and we have a lot of billeting over there, and we have a state employee that helps manage people using that billeting coming in and going out. Electronic security systems. Every armory has a vault, and we have some of the best small arms automatic weapon systems that the DOD can buy. They're in every armory that we have in this state, and we have an electronic security system that helps manage that and ensure that the vaults are secured correctly and there's a good response if needed. Equipment refurbishment. I'd like to talk a little bit about that a moment. That's going to be on the right side, second bullet down. We had a system that was helping refurbish all the equipment from the global war on terrorism. And National Guard Bureau basically said, here's 5 sites that are going to be doing this. Our site in Oregon managed generators, night vision devices, chemical alarms, and some trucks. With the decrease in the global war on terrorism and leaving Iraq and eventually Afghanistan, those sites are closing down. And so when we submitted our agency budget, we submitted this information in it. Subsequent to the submission of that agency budget, National Guard Bureau said, your site's closed. And so we have subsequently laid off all those employees. The last 31 employees were laid off between November and in December of this past year. And so that program is closing up, and we'll be working with the LFO's office to ensure that we phase out the state positions and then the federal fund limitation that exists up there. Distant learning, 2 state employees, basically computer-based training functions across this across the state. And then the last bullet I'd like to mention is the anti-terrorism program. We have 1 employee, 100% federally funded. This person works in our Joint Operations Center over at the Anderson Readiness Center, but then they also have a very, very close tie to the Fusion Center, and they do a lot of that anti-terrorism type actions in terms of the footprint and the risk and to armories and installations across this state.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, has the Oregon Guard transferred any equipment
to local police forces?
In regards to
excess equipment or
like M16s and those types of things?
Anything. You know, Mr. Chairman, the question is, you know, the press about the recent situations in Missouri and things like that as far as those police forces having military equipment. I don't.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, that program in moving DOD small arms or automatic weapons to police agencies or sheriff's departments is through the Department of Defense and not through the Oregon National Guard. We are not a part of that. I will tell you that I'll verify that and get an answer back tomorrow, but I'm almost positive that we don't touch that program.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And, Colonel, you're not aware of federal government providing any to our police forces in Oregon?
That I wouldn't be aware of.
We can ask the police, or state police.
And my former position in Oregon Emergency Management, I dealt with sheriff's departments all the time. I'm reasonably confident that there's weapon systems out there that have been transferred to sheriff's offices.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Gorsuch.
Colonel, to go back one slide, so the anti-terrorism program, I'm hoping after all the stuff that's gone on recently that the answer is true, but is the anti-terrorism person tied in with like the FBI and the regional task force, for instance, that they have in Portland in terms of terrorism and any other sorts of programs that we might have within the state?
Co-chairs, Representative Gorsuch, they're not a sitting member mm-hmm. on that task force. They're familiar with the actions that occur there. Most of the work that they do, that this person does, is tied into the Fusion Center and the Department of Justice component to that, and what that means to the state of Oregon. So we're really looking at the force protection of facilities within the state of Oregon and what threats those are. DOD produces certain risk matrices and actions that have to occur across the nation. This person helps analyze what Big Army and Big National Guard Bureau is saying, okay, well, what's the real risk to Oregon, and what do we need our soldiers doing at our armories? And so it kind of helps not necessarily filter, but apply the analytics to Oregon footprints.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you. Very familiar with Camp Riley, having been there a few times.
Yes, sir.
I was raised just down the road from there, so I'm wondering, I saw a tremendous buildup of homes and development pretty much up to. Has there been any conflict between private property owners, what takes place there, training?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, there's been noise restrictions that we've placed. There has been certain sound actions. Certain training has been curtailed, certain time periods of the day. My operational viewpoint of what occurred out at Camp Riley is a couple years removed. I can certainly get some updated information for you. But I recognize particularly the north end had buildings right up against the fence.
Yeah.
And so we generally stopped, small arms fire type actions past 2200 or 10 o'clock. A lot of the flight helicopter type activities that occurred, we kind of curtailed a little bit. And we want to be good neighbors, but we also recognize the standpoint that training post was there for a purpose.
They moved to you.
Sir, yeah. They did. Mm-hmm. And there was an easement issue that occurred out there during that time frame, too. And so in the end, we still try and be good neighbors.
Well, I can't go down that lake anymore and fish bass.
Slusher Lake. You want to go down there and fish bass? By all means. I've been down there a time or two also.
All right.
Senator Bates.
Well, just real quick, I think you mentioned that in the refurbishment program you lost about 30 jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Here in, you know, here in Oregon, we fight for every job we got. It's a huge problem, especially in rural Oregon. So where did those 30 jobs go to? Was the program completely dropped across the country, or was it moved somewhere else?
They were completely, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, they were completely dropped. And so these positions were all at Camp Withicum in Portland, Clackamas. And since there was no demand because of the wars for refurbishing night vision devices, generators, trucks, that demand lessened, those positions and that program went away.
Okay.
And so that was the reason for
they
the
weren't
loss.
Transferred to another state?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Thank you.
No, sir.
Please continue.
Okay. Operations program on the Air Guard side from a state perspective. So we have a small administration component in that helps manage the Air Guard side, also located in the same building as the Adjutant General and myself. Civil engineering program, we'll talk about later. There's a POP that affects at least the Portland Air Base civil engineering. But basically what we have is we have 26 employees at Portland Air Base, and then we have 28 employees at the Klamath Falls Air Base that help manage the operations and maintenance of those two air bases. Security program. It's 24/7, and on the state side, we have at the Portland Air National Guard base, we have 12, and then at Klamath Falls, we have 9, and so there's a constant security footprint required to ensure that fighter pilot mission is maintained. Fire protection, we also have another pot for that for the firefighters. I've had this discussions. I just want to just reemphasize one last time that we need those firefighters in order to get to secure, in order to make certain that those jets get in the air for their mission. And it was 100%. And just for clarification purposes, the fire protection fund used to be 100%. And it wasn't until language in the cooperative agreement, the National Guard Bureau language, what they directed on us, changed that cap. And basically it said you can only reimburse up to the federal limits. Well, state employees, and at least in the case of the firefighters, were getting more than some of the federal. That's what caused that delta, and so we had to come up with an option to help pay for that delta, and that's where that 1.4 with POP 201 is going to go to ensure that those firefighters maintain their jobs. Environmental, we have one environmental state person at each airbase, Klamath and Pang. And then in billeting, since Klamath Falls is a training base and it has a lot of pilots rotating in and out, we have a couple of two state employees that help manage the billeting program there. Just like to show a couple of pictures here. The new facility on the left is Fort Dallas, Dalles. And so the Dalles Readiness Center, Fort Dalles Readiness Center was completed in 2014, cost of $27 million. It was a collaborative effort between us and the Columbia River Columbia Gorge Community College. So basically, Community College pitched in $8 million. Federal funds was $4.8 million, and then through bonds was $4.3 million. And now we have an event that a facility that works both for our Armory, for our use, our soldiers, as well as the college. On the right, Melton Freewater. That's a remodel. That's that medium range remodel that's through the ASLIP or the Armory Service Life Extension Plan. And that was before, it was a 1954 building, again, way outdated, doesn't meet the needs of our current force structure. Our people have changed, equipment, vehicle, rolling stock. And so basically what we did was a very, very large remodel here with 100% state funds. And it it was 1.8 in federal funds. We were able to get some federal funds, and then 2.4 million in state Q bonds, and then that was able to increase the energy efficiency. We replaced outdated window glazing, added insulation, replaced and repaired major building systems. We enlarged the building, and then we also increased the compound and made some other site improvements. Most of these buildings aren't ADA. Most of them do not meet current code, so when we get a chance to go in and do a remodel, we also improve the building codes of those.
Slide.
No presentation would be complete without the obligatory picture of a fire truck. And those are the two fire trucks at both Portland and Kingsley. I would offer that we had an exercise, an Office of Emergency Management exercise last week, and it was on the oil spills, and we had it out at DPSST, and I was sitting next to the Keno fire chief, who is also the fire defense board chief for that Klamath Falls area, and he says, you know what, the second this spills, I'm just calling you guys anyway. You got 4,000 airmen out on the Kingsley. You have 3 crash trucks. You have 3 foam trucks. I know exactly where they're at. We have cooperative agreements with every one of you, and we're going to get you guys out there to help us. And I said, okay. So, I mean, just let us know, report after. But these, through cooperative agreements, even through conflagration that is managed through OSFM, these fire assets will deploy off the base and support other fire activities. And Kingsley does quite frequently, particularly during the fire season. Slide. The Office of Emergency Management, recently where I came from, we basically have three sections, the administration and three sections. The admin section is coordination and preparation, planning. Our basic tenets are mitigation, recovery, response, as well as preparedness. Our statutes are in 401, very, very specific on exactly what we do. We have four distinct sections, and I'll go into, or correction, three distinct sections underneath the administration section, program, preparedness, and disaster, and I'll cover each one of those. OEM's basic funding is about $2.1 million in general fund, $89 million in other fund. All that other fund is 911, and so about $80 million, $79 to $80 million a biennium is other fund, so that 75 cents per month that comes off of your phone bill, the department of, that the telcos collect, give to Department of Revenue, goes through our office to help manage, and I'll get into detail on that. And then the remainder of the money is $162 million federal fund expenditure limitation. We don't have that much in federal funds, but that's the limitation that we have to support the programs, and I'll go into it. First is the 911 section. It's under tech and response. Its goal is to provide a seamless, ongoing, statewide enhanced 911 across the state. Responsibility includes coordination management of the network, delivery of the 911 calls, customer premise equipment. So basically, OEM's 911 program supports the backbone for the 43 PSAPs that exist in this state, the primary service answering point or the 911 call center that exists in this state. In addition to that, the 911 program helps in 2013 had a legislative budget note to develop an approach for next generation or next gen 911. In the governor's budget released on 1 December, the governor has said, this is the next generation is a great program. What we want you to do is focus on the network first. And so we are taking this, we're going to bite this elephant off one bite at a time. And during this biennium, what we have been asked to do through the governor's budget is to just work on the network. And the network that exists out there is an old analog system. Its service life ends in June of 2017. And so we need to convert this old analog frame relay network into a digital network. And so that's the point of what we're going to be doing here for the next year and a half or prior to June of 17. And there's a reason. We'll come back to the money that it's going to take to do that and how it's going to be shifting to the DAS ETS program. Basically, what the 911 program does in managing the money component, it's going to go four different places. That 79 or 80 million that's raised in revenue a biennium, and we hope it's more, by the way, because of the prepaid issue many of you may have been involved in, the prepaid from the last session. We believe that's going to actually increase revenue. Legislative Revenue Office said it's about a million. We're hopeful it's higher. At any rate, of the 80 million, it's going to go to four places. Department of Revenue collects up to 1% to manage that, to collect it and send it out to where we ask them to send it. Up to 4% goes to OEM for administrative purposes. So when I'm saying OEM other fund, it's all the 911, up to 4%. Then we have 35% that goes into an equipment account, and that helps maintain that backbone by the customer service or premise equipment. And then the remainder, or 60%, goes to the actual PSAPs themselves. I would like to remind you that in a PSAP, only roughly 25% is paid for out of that revenue that I just mentioned, the 60%. The other 75% it takes to manage those 43 PSAPs across the state is done at the local level. So state is only paying for about a quarter of a PSAP is the bottom line, and it's the network or the backbone that we're paying for plus the call-taking equipment.
Just a comment. That was a long, hard-fought battle over many, lot of years, and I was glad to put it behind some of us last session.
Hopefully for a long time.
Hopefully for a long time.
It was painful. Yes.
Co-Chair Senator Winters, we're very, very happy that you were able to do that. It also extended the sunset from 2014 to 2021. 22. And so that was also very beneficial. So we wouldn't have to worry about that for a couple of biennium.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wissanet.
I apologize. Colonel, I missed the 1% to revenue, 4% to OMA.
OEM.
OEM.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wissanet, yes. 35% goes to an equipment account managed by OEM to pay for the network and customer premise equipment. And then 60% is distributed to the PSAPs directly.
To the 911
centers. To the 911 centers, yes, sir.
Thank you.
You bet. We also anticipate that the technology subcommittee is probably going to be asking for an update. And so we'll moving forward here on this technology project and moving it from an analog to digital, we expect more conversations on the policy side of that too. Moving on to the domestic preparedness section. The domestic preparedness section is basically our operational section. So within OEM, it's going to manage the plans, trainings, exercises, as well as the op site or managing the response, the shell of the response if we have to activate and help coordinate local actions. On the planning level, in recap, we have multiple planning efforts going on. The Cascadia playbook, the tag showed you yesterday, is one of them. Updating our emergency operations plan has to be maintained. That's being ongoing right now. A cyber planning effort that we're teaming with DASC is another planning endeavor, as well as making certain that counties, cities, and tribes have their EOP. Counties shall have an EOP. We help manage that. All 36 are good. Cities don't have to have a program. They may have an emergency management program, and if they do, then they have to have an EOP. But we've pushed that. If a city wants one, we'll try and get them one, and we have 95 out of the 242 cities that have an emergency operations plan. And then out of the 9 federally recognized tribe, our last one will have an EOP the end of this month, and so all the tribes will be good with EOPs. So a number of planning efforts. Exercises, also in domestic preparedness, is our biggest event. I mentioned the oil train exercise that we had last week, that Bakken oil. It's really tough to predict some of these hazards that come your way, and so we have to increase our planning as well as our exercise component when something like that happens. Additionally, we have our biggest exercise of since 2007. For those that might remember Top Off, we have a Cascadia Rising exercise coming in June of 2016, regional exercise. Here's the bottom line. We're going to test the Cascadia subduction zone playbook and plan. It's a regional exercise with FEMA, State of Washington. We're hopeful California gets involved in this also, as well as Canada and Alaska. And so June of 16, we have a lot of local involvement at this time, a lot of partnership. Don't know how full scale it's going to be. We're still waiting for the feds to kind of pony up some money to help support this. But right now it's mostly coming out of Hyde from city, county, and OEM purposes to try and help support this exercise. Last thing, couple things in domestic preparedness or the ops section is we have amateur radio. For those that are familiar with this, amateur radio is very, very important to us. When all things fail, when the cell phone goes down, the cell phone towers come to the ground, and the lines get cut, it's probably going to be amateur radio that's going to be able to communicate across the state. And so we still have an amateur radio section, and that's also in this domestic preparedness program. And we also have search and rescue. Tag mentioned yesterday, the Adjutant General mentioned the search and rescue with the helicopters and the Oregon Guard. The actual search and rescue program is housed by statute in the Office of Emergency Management. So we help manage that program and in support of the sheriffs, because the sheriffs actually own the search and rescue responsibilities in this state by statute. Last item on the disaster program. Disaster program formerly run by Sean McCormick out of OEM. We have a number of actions that are going on. So the disaster program helps manage the after the disaster happens. And so since 1986, we've had 16 presidential declarations totaling $183 million. So basically, OEM helps grind sausage. This federal money comes in. We help put it to projects and help repair public infrastructure that's occurred by the locals on the ground. And so that's what that section really does in terms of the federal money, and that's really where the lion's share of our limitation is because that disaster money and those disaster grants in response to the presidential declarations. We have 5 presidential declarations still open and still managing those projects across this state. In addition to that, this program also does natural hazard mitigation planning to ensure that all those natural hazards that could be affected by a jurisdiction, there's some sort of compensation for that, as well as recovery, and that's been Mr. McCormick's main effort here on the planning side, is developing that recovery plan, that framework that it's going to take post-Cascadia or something else, and it's going to be a scalable plan. We released it on 31 December, and that plan is fairly complete. Bottom line on OEM, just to kind of recap, the adage is all the sections are going to support a response and the management of the ECC or the Emergency Coordination Center, and even during flood season, the earthquake lady will bail. And so that's kind of how that's how we manage that OEM process, and we're multi-hatted. Slide. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Aye. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel Stuggy, Civil Air Patrol, do you interface with them at all? Are you supporting them? I have a major in my district that's always saying they'd like more help and they want to be involved. Is that still an active role in search and rescue in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, there's a couple of answers to that. The short answer is yes. We actually have a memorandum of agreement with Civil Air Patrol. We are one of the first ones that helped create this agreement that we can incorporate them, or the locals can incorporate them and help pay for some of their services if they needed those. In addition, Representative Wisnett, they've also we also incorporate them in exercises. We will ask for their assistance when we have like one of those EPIRBs, one of the beacons going off. The Air Force Reserve Center out of Tyndall Air Force Base may help call on them with their CAP federal hat, non-paid, state doesn't have to pay, in order to help go out and try and turn off one of those beacons that may be stuck in an airplane that's going off, because every one of those beacons has to be traced, whether it's in an airport hangar or whether it's actually gone down from an accident. And so there's a number of actions where we've helped coordinate with the CAP. They're involved in a number of our exercises. For us to get the total involvement, to get them to take their federal hat off and put their state hat on, we need a funding source in a lot of regards. And sometimes that just doesn't happen.
Thank you. I'll maybe talk to you offline on that.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Community support programs, Youth Challenge. Quite frankly, at this point in time, I'd like to stop my monotone delivery and bring up Dan Radabaugh.
Mr. Chair, good evening, members. I'm Dan Radabaugh, Director of the Oregon Youth Challenge Program.
So quick, just general. This program, the two phases, go ahead.
The Youth Challenge Program, it's broke up into two phases. It's a 22-week residential phase, where the students are on-site 24/7 doing academics, service to community projects, and after that graduation, then they move into a 12-month post-residential phase where they work with a mentor from their hometowns. So the entire program is 17 months long. I'd like to answer your questions from yesterday, Senator Bates. The waiting list, we don't have a traditional waiting list per se. What we do is we do 8 orientations for each class, and the families and potential applicants come to the program, and they are briefed, they get tours, they get to see videos, they have the opportunity to sit down and speak with the staff and cadets who are currently in the class. Once they've attended an orientation, then they're eligible to submit an application. And we take those applications, we put them into our database, and then we sit down with a team and we seat the class. Those qualified applicants who are not invited, they get a phone call. We let them know that they will be contacted again in about 3 to 4 months to see if they're still interested in the program and to see if they still meet the eligibility criteria. And if they do, and if they would like to be a part of the next class, we put them at the top of the list.
Follow-up question?
Follow-up.
What's the eligibility or requirements?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, eligibility criteria is you must be 18 years of age. You have to be a high school dropout or not likely to graduate on time with your class. You must be drug-free. No pending legal charges. You can't be on parole or probation. You must be a resident of the state of Oregon and the United States.
Well, if you don't make the cut the first time and it's 3 or 4 or 5 months down the road, you're going to age out of that program potentially before you get a chance to get into it. How many people do you cut out each time? I mean, if you have a certain number of applicants, how many you got to call up and say in 3 or 4 months we'll look at you again?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, what we do when we seat our class is we look at the 18-year-olds first, and then we go to the 17-year-olds and then the 16-year-olds, because we are sensitive to the fact that some of the cadets or potential applicants could age out of the program.
Follow-up? And how do people know about this program? Do parents come to you? Do the school systems come to you? We've got a 60% graduation rate in this state of in high school, so that 40% represents a little bit more than you're taking care of here, just a little bit. How do they find out about the program?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, we have a recruiter on site who goes out, spends about 16 days a year speaking to community leaders, organizations who are interested in the program, school administrators, to get the youth challenge out there to the youth groups. But for the most part, our students come to us through word of mouth. Our graduates, our parents who've had a kid in the program, and our mentors who mentor the cadets after in the post-residential phase are the main way we get our cadets to come to us.
Last question. What are the outcomes like? How do these kids do after going through the program?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, they do exceptionally well. We track them each month in the post-residential phase to make sure that they're on track with their cadet action plan, which is a plan where they develop goals in the program to work with their mentors for the following year. They're required to return to high school, go on to college, join the military, or enter the workforce, and they report back each month to tell us where they are in their cadet action plan. And right now we are at about 83% success rate on the cadets who are reporting back. Just because they don't report back doesn't mean they're not successful. Some kids are just not responsible enough to report back to us.
Well, I guess another way, Mr. Chair, of asking the question, what percentage of the 156 that are in the class actually go all the way through to graduation? You know, after the first week, second week, how many are actually don't continue the program?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we start out with 156 cadets for each class. We typically lose probably about 15 cadets during the first 2 weeks of the program. That's the acclimation phase where they learn the structure, the routine, the discipline required to stay in the program. Once they start school in the third week, they start seeing A's and B's instead of D's and F's on report cards. They start getting some self-esteem and pride in what they are accomplishing there at U Challenge. And our graduation rate, the target for the federal funding is 120 cadets, and we usually graduate anywhere between 125 and 135. So the success rate of the program is very well.
Another piece that I, because I'm very supportive of your program, so I probably know a little bit more of it. And what percentage are male and what percentage are females that are in your program? And also, what percentage of them return back and graduate with their own high school class?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, the makeup of our students is 75% male, 25% female. That's nationally. It's pretty much the percentages that most programs see. And I'm sorry, your second question? The students returning back to their high schools. We don't track their graduation rates. It's because some of them go back at 16 years of age, they're juniors, and they still have 2 years of school. So we don't see the complete outcome on that. But for the 12 months that they are reporting back to us, I'd say that it's anywhere from 95 to 100% are still in school, in high school.
One of your requirements that I don't see listed here is that the student has a mentor, if you will, both while they're in the process as well as when they return back to the community. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, they have a mentor. They come to the program with two mentor applications. We check into the mentors. We do background investigations, sex offender checks, and make sure that they're upstanding citizens before we match the students with the cadets.
I'm just trying to help you along a little bit.
great question.
Let's conclude the victory lap and head towards the finish line.
The question is, what's keeping you from expanding?
Here, if you want a softball.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, what's keeping us from expanding is money. The dropout population for the state of Oregon is out there. We just need the funds to build.
And just to help you a little bit
last
more.
Last follow-up.
Because you get ADM weighted from the local school district, and the amount that they're giving you from that ADM is not 100%.
That's correct.
So there's a win-win on both sides, and some of these are students who may or may not be in class. In fact, typically they're not in class, so they're not getting ADM weighted for them. Just had to add that little caveat.
No, it's important. I think, you know, for me, I haven't been on the subcommittee for 4 years, and so that type of detail is helpful.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, you're absolutely right. Our ADM, it is a pass-through through Ben Lapine School District. They take 20% of the ADM for their services.
Okay. Nice job.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just to recap, later on you're going to see a quality performance measure at KPM, and it's going to show that the youth challenge is red. That measurement, we respectfully request a modification to that. We're going to work with staff to ensure that we can try and provide something that's a little bit more realistic in terms of the youth challenge. Right now, it's a very, very narrow measurement where it's talking about high school graduation or GED during phase one for 17 and 18 only. And as you've just heard, the totality of this program, phase one, phase two, they also earn some credits, 8 credits, as well as diploma, high school, or GED. It's a much broader perspective, and so you're going to see a KPM that doesn't fully address or represent what we're asking the Youth Challenge Program to do. Moving on the emergency ops, these two pictures on the right are Youth Challenge. Lower left is we basically have a fund that is empty that we drop our state costs into for active duty when guardsmen need to go support a mission. And this last December e-board, we requested and received $600K and other fund limitation to cover for the pay and lodging costs for the 2014 session. So those 101 soldiers that you saw go and support fires in the Adjutant General slide yesterday, we drop it into that emergency ops program in order to get the limitation. And that, in this case, in the fires, it's all reimbursed through Oregon Department of Forestry. We have an agreement with ODF when it comes to firefighting. Other state active duty missions and supports are a little bit different. Slide, please.
Mr. Chair, real quick.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel Stuggy, does Forest Service train your people, or how is the training received by your people?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, as it applies to the aviation, it's a part of their job. It's a skill set. It's not a laid on skill set to be a bucket carrier pilot. So they have to do some additional training that they do, I think, through their own. But as it applies to firefighters, we work through Oregon Department of Forestry. They train us for that FF2 card, and I believe it's 3 days on the ground with a day of travel on each end in order to train those crews if needed.
Follow up real quick. equipment for the ground fighters, firefighters?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wiz, the ground crews?
Yeah, how do they get additional equipment? The Forest Service? Or?
There are a couple of different ways. Some through ODF, so we get the fire suits, yeah. The fire retardant suits through Oregon Department of Forestry. We have to go out and buy the boots. So most of the boots that we have are not fire retardant; they're military Afghanistan retardant, and so we have to go buy new boots in order to help the old black boots in order to make certain that the soldiers can be out there fighting on fires. And so those are bought through our military department.
How much are you supporting this? I mean, it depends on knowing the fire season, but is it a frequent?
Every Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, every year we will support fires and have supported fires in one form or fashion, whether it's through the Oregon Military Department, through aviation aircraft, through firefighter duty, through securities. We've seen a broadening of this where they needed just security elements to be out there helping managing checkpoints. 2 years ago, the big fire season we had 25 different checkpoints in Josephine County just in closing off roads. And so we will be, I suspect, who knows if it's every year? I would suspect it's probably in some form or fashion every year.
I'll talk offline and find out again. I have a lot of employees in my district that they do that for a living, and I know that the fire, sometimes we need them and want them out there, but I don't know when it triggers them and what it does, and I'll look into that myself.
Our motto is last called, first out, and so we won't compete with the Oregon Department of Forestry has a will call list. They go to those civilian agencies first when it comes to those aviation outfits. And so in a lot of regard, when I say we're out there, one of them is the medevac purposes. So picture the ground that we have. A lot of the state managed forests or the private industry forests are just laced with roads, no issues. If you have an injury and you need to get a firefighter out, get them evac'd, you have a road to get to them. The Wild Forest Service lands will allow a forest picture in northeast corner. You're not going to get into some of those areas on horseback for 3 days. And so the feds oftentimes work through Oregon Department of Forestry to ask us and that medevac unit that you see over in Salem to be ready to respond. And that unit gets called frequently to sit on a ramp and be able to provide air medevac for a firefighter.
Mr. Chair. Robert, then we're going to move on.
Okay. This is important to my district, and thank you, Colonel Stuckey. Do you charge, if you picked up an injured firefighter that's contracted, does he get charged for your service from the rescue helicopter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, if the medevac mission has been asked for, there's a declaration, and there's a process that ODF has asked for that medevac aircraft, and it is sitting on a ramp somewhere to go pick up an injured firefighter. There's no additional charge. Those charges are through Oregon Department of Forestry and the Oregon Military Department through an agreement. We would not charge the injured
just
person.
For the committees, and this, we're not agriculture, but one of my constituents had a crew out fighting a fire, and a kid passed out, and AirLife picked him up. Even though the crew chief said he was okay, they picked him up and charged the company $25,000 for their service.
Wow.
Now, in spot and time. Other programs, moving on. Debt service program is where a lot of our debt repayment is and the interest costs for the management of the buildings. We have the Roseburg Armory that's pictured here, is an Armory service life extension plan. It's currently under design right now, so this building, as you see on the right, clearly is in need of some help. At this point in time, the legislature approved $2.2 million in Q bonds, and then we crossed our fingers and got $2.7 in federal funds. So this building is going to be able to have, when it's completed, new doors, windows, installations, critically seismically upgraded, as well as we're going to stick in an emergency potable well in the back so we have a new water source to help the local community. We envision, General Hokanson envisions, every single armory that we have out there at some stage is going to be a support to the locals in case of response. We even get it down to the other day we were having a design meeting on trying to make certain that we had a big enough parking lot if we needed that parking lot to help support the locals in terms of an emergency and have big tenage or whatever set up. So that's kind of how we're thinking in terms of remodeling and trying to make certain that the design works for our force structure, our units, as well as potential state mission. Quality performance measures. We have green, amber, red, green, yellow, red. We have six of them that are green, one yellow, and then the two in red. The first six in green, I'm only going to cover a couple of them. Recruiting is number one to us. Very, very important. Tag top priority. Without the soldiers, we don't get the we don't have the units. Without the units, everything else just kind of falls after that. And so recruiting and retention is always a high priority of ours in this all-volunteer Army and Air Force. This past year, we were fairly high up. On the air side, we were fifth in the nation. And then on the Army side, we were 43rd out of 54. But we look at that 95% as the recruiting goal for the entire reporting period. And so from an actual standpoint, in this KPM, we did extremely well. Reintegration, I want to move down to that bottom left corner. I know there's a lot of topic and concern about that. They have sustainment operations where they have to help take care of soldiers that have deployed in the past. And then as General Hokanson mentioned, we got about 1,000 coming home between now and the end of this legislative session. And so there's a lot of activity going on with those 48 personnel. General Hokanson mentioned we have another $1.4 million in Fed funds that came through a couple of weeks ago, a week and a half ago, and that's going to help support 10 additional people. And so that team, career fairs, job search, health, welfare checks, all those actions inside the reintegration or the assistance program for those returning soldiers is very, very critical. And just to crow a little bit on the customer service, we've moved up from 72% to 82%, and we broaden out our base on who we're asking, whether or not we're serving our customers well. Policy, local policy, as well as you, at the county level, emergency managers, sheriffs, et cetera. And so we're very proud of the fact that our customer service percentages are going up. The two in red.
Just a moment, Colonel.
Just going back to KPMs, I look at KPMs and a lot of other budgets. I've never seen anyone at 50% as a goal. Most of them are up to 80%, 85%. And I'm surprised the armor condition's only at the goal is 50%. I'm glad you're at 79. But the goal is 50%. Seems strange. And your customer service goal is 55%. That seems low, too. Is it based on some – most customer service goals are in the 90% range. Range and you're at 55. What's whatever those goals set so low?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, in regards to customer satisfaction, that's a really good question. Why that's low? It doesn't seem necessarily realistic. 90% would mean that we're not meeting that goal.
Yeah,
but clearly 50%, 55% does seem unrealistic. We certainly can get back to the genesis behind why that number was created.
Struck me as strange.
Yes, in regards to the armory condition, we're just looking at that in terms of the facilities, and we've actually had over the years quite a bit of hits to our armory installation staff, and so we've had a lot of deferred maintenance that has added up over the years. That's why it's important that we have that ASLIP program and other construction to try and modernize these things. But in the end, in 2011, like everyone else, we got a budget cut. We lost people, and one of the biggest hits in the military department was about 15 installation staff that helped manage those armories across this state. And again, that's 3.3 million square feet. That's a lot of square footage for the people that we have working it right now. I just offer on the youth challenge, we're just looking for a more realistic. We believe it's a great program. We're proud of our community support programs, and we want to see that a more realistic challenge. Budget drivers, environmental factors. Move to the third one, Army National Guard Fire Protection. Again, that's the cooperative agreement. That's POP 201. The next one down, deferred maintenance. is deferred maintenance is that $79 million that I was talking about earlier that we're looking at and trying to manage, and the service life extension program helps support that. 2011, again, 15 fewer positions. Moving on, OEM federal grants, you live by the grant, you're probably going to not necessarily succeed. I don't want to say die by the grant, but OEM has two main grants out there. It's a Homeland Security grant. For those that were around in the mid-2000s, that was as high as $35 million. It's now $4.8 million. And so most of that is passed through. 80% of it goes to the locals. OEM can't keep it. It's got to go straight to them. And so that's gone down. The EMPG grant, the second grant, is the Emergency Managed Performance Grant. That's stayed held steady. That's a people money grant. And so those emergency managers that you see out there, or even those that are in the sheriff's department, and usually we have about staffing about 90 people on the Emergency Management Performance Grant at the local level. And those people, it's all 50-50, and it's hard. It's a hard match. They must come up with local cash in order to support the other half of that grant. And then the very last one, we'll talk about limited space for Youth Challenge. Slide. Major changes last 10 years, OEM, 2007, went from OSP to OEM. Had a lot of different changes in this world that's happened. Bakken fuel oil, no one would have ever expected the Tohoku EQ and the fact in 2011 and the fact that resulted in a marine debris issue. And that required additional actions by us. All those natural hazards, everything seems to, just when we think we got a handle on them, they're going to change. And so cyber obviously is the hot button right now, and so there's a number of things. And OEM's the seismic rehab program moved from us to OBDD during the two sessions ago. And then we also have the Oregon Resiliency Program, Oregon Resiliency Task Force, and you'll probably hear more about that. It's being heard on the House side, starting with in regards to response to the Cascadia and what could be happening to make Oregon more resilient. Square footage mentioned, our footage, we've increased in square footage. We've actually decreased some of our energy usage, and we'll talk about that later. Umatilla, caretaker. Umatilla used to be a chemical depot. In 2002, we entered into this caretaker contract, and right now we have a couple of buildings in a small footprint. We're looking for a license for Umatilla so we can turn that into an actual training area, and then there's an effect to Umatilla and what we want to replicate out at Umatilla with what's at RTI, or the Regional Training Institute at Western Oregon today. And then I mentioned the ACELIP program, and those are the armories, the six that were completed since 2007.
Colonel Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of Umatilla, all of the chemical destruction has taken place there. Is that right?
That is correct.
Do you know when that was completed?
2012.
Okay.
I believe.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So under the cost, this slide basically kind of categorizes the containment. And so from our standpoint, a lot of what we've been doing, particularly on the facility side, is the containment in the energy arena, both in LEED certifications. We've increased our square footage with our new armories, with our remodels of our armories by 30%, yet we've decreased our energy consumption by 11%. We're looking at some upcoming energy projects. There's several things that we would like to do. We're in the design phase of a solar array project out at the Pendleton Army Aviation Facility that could save up to $16,000 a year. We're also installing a biomass wood pellet boilers at two sites in Redmond and Camp Biak, or that Central Oregon training site. We also are considering solar panel arrays at five other sites across the state, and we're in discussions with ODOT on a potential 2-megawatt solar project. And our last renewable project that I'll mention is a wave energy at Camp Rylea, and we've signed a memorandum of understanding agreement with Oregon State to look at wave energy. So we have looked at a number of different energy options to try and figure out how to save money for this agency in this state. The first tests for that, for the wave energy, are scheduled to begin in the fall of 2015. major budgetary issues. The very first thing I'd like to highlight is on number one is look to the right on the technical adjustment. The Joint Forces Headquarters building did not make the governor's recommended budget. There was a concern about the siting of that building, which is sited behind the Anderson Readiness Center. And for those that don't know, the Anderson Readiness Center houses 4 out of 5 24/7 operations. It has the Army Guards or the National Guards Joint Operations Center. It has one of two OSP command centers. The other one's in Central Point. It has the best, one of the better high-tech ODOT regional area operations centers. And then it has ORS, which is our 24/7 call-taking center, the Oregon Emergency Response System. That's 4/24/7. ECC goes up, gets activated, that's 5. So we are looking at Anderson Readiness Center and a potential new Joint Forces Headquarters building behind Anderson as kind of the hub to help support a response to support the locals in this state. And outside of wherever you're all at and wherever the governor's at, we think that's probably the third most important building structure in the state of Oregon when it comes time for an emergency. So we basically had to go back to and do a study to ensure that that building was sited correctly, that it wasn't in a floodplain. It is not. And now we're working for options with BAM, as well as the Legislative Fiscal Office and Linda to try and figure out different options where we could potentially add this building back in. The building is roughly $18.5 million in federal dollars, and we're asking for 6.7 in general fund coupons. Next item, mentioned the general fund for the firefighters. Third, general fund for the CE operation. 4 is the next gen project, and that's really not necessarily next gen, and I wish that wasn't up there. It's really just turning the frame relay into a digital system, and it's technology agnostic. We have a frame relay system that has to be changed. End of life is June of 2017, and we're looking at the governor's budget moves some limitation, $500K in 911 limitation from us to the DAS ETS group in order to help do that, the Enterprise Technology Services Group. Moving on, general fund debt service, that's the item where we have right now RTI and the Youth Challenge. And then capital construction, we just have some correction. Moving on to Umatilla caretaker contract, what we're looking at there is a policy option package for 23 limited duration positions, and it's all federal funds. And to go back to your question, the chemical depot was, the entire stockpile was finally burned in 2011. So it was burned from 2004 to 2011, and that was the completion of all the bad nerve agents and mustard gas that was out there. Proposed capital construction projects. The two that I mentioned, RTI, again, that's to replicate what we've talked about is with Western Oregon is they give us $5 million through bonds. We're asking for 6.5 with the $11.5 million that we have at the Regional Training Institute in Monmouth. We use that money to apply to Umatilla once we get that lease signed, and then we're able to replicate those training functions, the skills training, the leadership training, both on the enlisted side as well as the officer side. And then Youth Challenge you're familiar with, and then there's some planning projects that we have in there. Next slide.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colonel, can we go back to the, or where, are we still there? Yeah, we are still there. All right. So, in terms of the machine gun range, do you have ranges at other facilities that have been retrofitted? Because I believe Withcombs closed many, many years ago. So, where are your ranges at?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, the 4 training sites that we have, Camp Rylea has on the coast between Seaside and Astoria has small arms, M16. M4 and down 9 mil. Okay. They also has the shoot house at Central Oregon, the training site in Redmond, BAC training site that we call it, believe it does not have any small arms ranges whatsoever. Camp Withycombe has been closed. Has been closed a number of years. We used to have a known distance range out there. And what we're looking at is Umatilla right now has two ranges where we entered into an agreement prior to them closing, prior to the Army leaving Umatilla, and it was still an Army depot. We had two ranges out there, an M4 range as well as a 9mm range. What we don't have at any ranges is a full-up multi-purpose machine gun range, so that 240 Bravo weapon system, the 7.62 weapon system, that range capability for a qualification for a soldier in today's environment only exists or can be replicated either at Fort Lewis or at Hunter Liggett. And so it's very problematic to try and put soldiers on buses to get that qualification rating that we need. And so that's why that multi-purpose machine gun range is so important, if we can get the federal funds in order to, and the site secured. And we're still in negotiation. We have an environmental impact statement that we're working on with the Navy, because the Navy owns Boardman. And Boardman is the only restricted airspace in the state of Oregon. It is a very, very important piece of airspace for both the Navy, the Air National Guard to fly their F-15s, because they still have a ground-to-air capability, our helicopters that have an air-to-ground capability, as well as a machine gun range. And so we've been in negotiation for some time, and we have this environmental impact statement out there that's to try and help get the training that we need.
Thank you.
Again, here's our regional training institute in Monmouth, and what we'd like to replicate out at Umatilla, $11.5 million to help replicate some of the sites that we have and some of the actions that would be occurring out there in the facility side. Slide. Youth challenge. Slide.
You don't need me to comment anymore.
It was a small pause, and it was.
She holds her cards close to her.
I was looking at the chair just now. Summary of revenue. And our summary of revenues, basically the high point here is the 911, and that's the tax that comes through that's collected, and that's basically the bulk of what we have listed up there. Historical, and this is historical general fund, and in historical general fund, this three biennial look, 2011-13, we had over $9 million. Current biennium, it dropped by about $2 million, and then in this current budget, we're looking at approximately $8.4 million. And so the governor's budget right now has been kind to us with this, with an uptick from the last biennium. Other funds, historical spending. Again, 911, and you'll see that there's a seismic blip in there from the 2011 as it applies to the seismic rehab program moving to Oregon Business Development. And then other funds, federal. As I mentioned previously, most of this through the Master Cooperative Agreement. It's either through the National Guard Bureau or through Department of Homeland Security, as it applies to the OEM side of things. And most of this is just pass-through money that goes to locals. Here's our proposed legislation. First one is basically to modify statute in 911. We're moving forward in next gen. We're hopeful that we'll be able to implement next generation and coming bienniums. Not this biennium, but future bienniums. And we need the statute to change, because it's all definitioned. And right now it's either 911 or E91. And so this 2426 is making this technology agnostic. So 10 years from now, if we have another change, our lawyers say we can make that change. 2427 came to us from the city of Portland. Basically, emergency managers, about 60% of emergency managers across this state are employed through a law enforcement agency, sheriff's office. And the other 40% are through commissions or otherwise. And so we're looking at a means that potentially allows for lights to go on emergency manager vehicles so they can get from point A to point B or get their policymaker from point A to point B. And it's either red or amber type lights. City of Portland came to us. We said we would help honor that and produce a legislative concept for it. 2428's housekeeping, remove an Oregon State Defense Force from an emergency service volunteer, which they operate up underneath us when needed. And then 235 is just another admin change, and there's an issue on accounting. I would offer Senate Bill 408 is heard a couple last week, and it's asking for some general fund for the museum. It's the Heritage Outreach Foundation. It's a nonprofit foundation. So we support the Oregon Military Museum. For those that have been to Clackamas and have seen that move, we have about six projects totaling $3.6 million now to make that move, but that's not enough. There's displays, et cetera, and the Heritage Outreach Foundation is looking for additional means to help paint that picture of our military history. And so I think it's going to probably get referred to Ways and Means somewhere. Slide. Our 10% reduction plan, the top three, when we submitted it, the governor said thank you. And the bottom ones were just options that we had out there, but they weren't accepted in the governor's budget. Long-term vacancies. No, there's a question on this. The top group is that 33. Originally, it was 64 total, but now in this current, it's 33 positions where that whole program goes away. That equipment refurbishment program goes away. The nine at Umatilla is a caretaker where we're trying to get a total of 23 through the federal program. We're trying to get BRAC to help fund that. The five wildfire are seasonal positions. We only ask for that wildfire program because we have statutory responsibility to help protect our own training lands. And for those you're familiar with, we have a contract with Bureau of Land Management for a training site in Central Oregon. We start a fire out there during training, we got to put it out. So we have a very small crew of wildland firefighters that help support our training facilities. Moving on, OEM 911. We recruited that three different times, trying to find a GIS geek and pay him more than the state, than private sector is very, very hard. And then installation staff are positions that are help manage our rental program, and so they're limited duration, temporary positions that are difficult to fill. Five of them are military lease agents that are difficult or intermittent filling, to be exact. Slide. List of appendixes. Slide. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that concludes our testimony for today. We stand ready to serve our state and our country. What are your questions?
I just have.
Thank you, Colonel. Senator Winters.
I don't have a question. I have a request. Today in Human Services, we heard at great length and discussed at great length a gap in a study that was done in order to look for general assistance. And in that process came up the discussion about veterans and the number of veterans who we have that are homeless and that all have various service needs and what have you. And my question is, when, particularly the guards, when the deployment ends and what have you, what kind of educational program exists to tell them what services exist for them, and what kind of work do you do with the Veterans Association? Because to me, I mean, we're talking about how do we actually deal with this gap, of services. So if you can, don't need it now, but if you can look at that and come back to us, because we're actually looking at it with, you know, within the other department. So I'm one that like to make certain that we're all on the same page and they're all looking at the same problem and trying to come up with a solution that we can all work on.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we can certainly provide that answer if you want us to provide that later.
Please do. If there's a way to incorporate it tomorrow, great.
Absolutely.
If not, feel free to send a response to the professional staff and she'll distribute it.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Well done, Colonel. Appreciate it, staff, all of your hard work. Linda, you want to tee it up for tomorrow?
Tomorrow, We will have the governor's budget overview of the military department, as well as public testimony.
Good. And this meeting is adjourned. Adjourned.